Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Duke Ellington knew how to dazzle, to excite, to pull music out of his extraordinary orchestra and make it the nation's. Edward Kennedy Ellington grew up African-American and so princely they called him Duke. Biographer Terry Teachout calls him the greatest jazz composer of the 20th century, a very public man in performance, but also a deep enigma. This hour on Point, Duke Ellington. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your go-to Duke Ellington tune? How do you hear his music now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Terry Teachout, author, playwright, and biographer, a jazz bassist himself, drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, critic at large at Commentary. He wrote the big book Pops on Louis Armstrong, All in the Dances on George Balanchine. His big new biography is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Terry Teachout, welcome to On Point. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom.
You get way inside this guy, and he's not easy to get inside. He didn't mean to be gotten inside.
No.
Remind us first of his public persona. We'll have listeners who are young enough that they recognize the music, but may never have seen a moving image of the man. Duke Ellington in motion, on the public stage. What was he like?
He was the great charismatic stage personality. Urbane, polished, full of elegant catchphrases. He always liked to assure his audiences that he loved them madly. And all of it was designed to disarm them and also to protect the man within.
We'll talk about that man within. Where'd he come from? What was the background on Edward Kennedy Ellington?
Born in Washington, D.C., 1899. D.C. at that time was one of the most segregated cities in the United States, but it also had a well-developed, self-conscious, and proud black middle class. That was what Ellington was born into, and that's one of the keys to understanding him. He's not like Louis Armstrong, who came from the roughest block in New Orleans, whose mother was a part-time prostitute. Ellington's father was first a butler, then an independent businessman, and he was raised to know which fork to use. And for the rest of his life, that respectability with which he was bred was absolutely essential to his self-understanding.
But underneath that, you write about rage, humiliation, and unbridled sensuality.
All those things and more.
This is not what we immediately associate with that very suave showman on stage. Maybe the sensuality once the band gets going, but rage and humiliation from a middle-class kid coming up, pretty well healed out of Washington?
Well, he was pretty well healed, but like any other black man in America in the 20s and 30s and 40s and well into the 60s, he knew the sting of racism. Up close and personal, he did his best, and his manager, Irving Mills, did his best to shield him from it. But there was only so much insulation that was possible, even for a very famous, successful man like Ellington. And he took it to heart, as who would not?
Well, look at that. I want to come to it through the music, his music chops. He was a pianist, of course. How did he get on that train? And did he always play? Or did he mainly play? When did he just conduct? When did he jump right in with his band and play?
Well, to begin with, he wasn't a child prodigy. Music came to him comparatively late. He actually got bad grades in music in school in Washington.
Okay.
It wasn't until he first heard a kind of ragtime jazz piano player named Harvey Brooks that the light went on and he realized this was something that spoke to him personally. This was something that he could do. And that was the great transformation. And he went right home and started playing that piano that he'd been ignoring. And then he became himself. Billy Strayhorn, his close collaborator, said that Ellington plays piano, but his real instrument is the orchestra. That said, he was a fine pianist who got better as he got older. He actually became, in the 50s and 60s, a more interesting soloist than he had been. So he was always up on the bandstand, always seated at the piano, leading the band from it. But the real manifestation of his great musical gifts was the orchestra for which he wrote.
Born in 1899 and plunged right in. So these things go way back. Here's 1927, Creole Love Call, with vocals here by Adelaide Hall, one of his first big compositions, Duke Ellington and his band. Jazzy, we're old-timey right away, and that high line that at first you think might be a muted trumpet, that's Adelaide.
That's exactly what it sounds like, and the story of how it happened is very typical, characteristic of Ellington. He'd written the piece, but not with the vocal part in mind, and they were playing it on stage, and Adelaide Hall is standing in the wings, and you know she's carried away, and she just kind of starts singing along with it, and he hears it, and he says, "I want that." And he brought her into the recording studio and cut this record.
He improvised all the time. He grabbed whatever was around and made it his own. I mean, even this sort of built on an earlier composition, Camp Meeting Blues by King Oliver, who was sort of part of the story of Duke Ellington getting into the Cotton Club in the first place.
Yes, that's right. The Cotton Club was the great break of Ellington's life, and he wasn't originally intended for it. Oliver's band was considered, other groups were considered, but they didn't realize what the potential of this gig was, and Ellington did. And he was also willing to deal with the circumstances of the gig, which were he would be working for mobsters, he would be playing in a segregated club, which was located in Harlem, but did not admit black people as customers.
Let's just focus on that for a second. You talk about rage and humiliation. Everybody on stage, the serving staff, essentially black. The customers, almost 100% white.
That's right. If you were a very famous black man, somebody like, say, Paul Robeson, you could get a corner table in the shadows, maybe, but not with a mixed party. The Cotton Club was absolutely rigid in this policy, and Ellington, he didn't talk about it. He talked about what a great break it was, and it was. It was a tremendous break for him. He talked about how he actually liked working for the mobsters. His boss, Oney Madden, was a multiple murderer, but he got along very well with them. He talked about the elegance and polish of the audiences. But this crucial aspect of the Cotton Club, the fact that it was segregated, was something about which he wished to say nothing and did say nothing.
Always that tension, this proud, elegant man working with a great big country full of some gnarly racial issues. Here's Ellington, also from 1927, Duke Ellington, and with his black and tan fantasy, Duke Ellington and his Washingtonians, as they were called then. And tan fantasy. You know, Terry Teachout, a couple generations later, this was almost the kind of music that they ran behind black and white Saturday morning cartoons. what did this sound like to the ears of listeners in 1927?
It sounded like a combination of the blues, of something very funky, very earthy, and that tremendously sophisticated saxophone line that you're hearing back in the background. That was the key to what Ellington was up to. His music was a synthesis of the sophisticated and the earthy. And you used the word pride a moment ago to describe him, and it's really essential to understanding him and his music. Notice that this piece is called Black and Tan Fantasy in 1927. Ellington was very, very race conscious, and he saw his music as an expression of racial pride.
Explicitly, right there in the title, and the pride being what? Here's our stuff, and it's earthy, and it's sophisticated.
And it's great, it's serious, it's significant, because one of the keys to understanding how Ellington came across in the 20s and 30s is that he was presented by his manager, Irving Mills, and this accorded with his own personality, not just as another band leader, another jazz band leader, even another black jazz band leader, but as a man apart, as a composer, a major composer, someone who was to be taken as seriously in his own field as a composer like Stravinsky was to be taken in his.
We'll look at how he rode that theme all the way to Carnegie Hall and well beyond. All kinds of amazing tensions, amazing elegance, amazing earthiness, and amazing enigmas residing behind all that. Terry Teachout writes about it all in his new biography, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. You can join our conversation this hour. Did you grow up with Ellington? How do you hear Duke Ellington now? What was Ellington's stamp on jazz, on his time? Does he make you want to take the A-train, ease your mood, indigo? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Terry Teachout, please stand by right there in New York. It's so great to have you. We'll go out here with another 1927 Duke Ellington composition, Black Beauty, from the Cotton Club days. Black Beauty, a portrait of Florence Mills, big African-American cabaret singer of the time. I'm Tom Ashbrook, with Duke Ellington, our subject this hour. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great showman, the great jazz man, Duke Ellington, the aristocrat of jazz. His wonderful mood indigo behind us here. Personal favorite. Terry Teachout has written a big life of Ellington, and it's got all the persona that you know up front, all the performance up front, all the composition, but also a deeply personal story about an enigmatic man who liked to keep it in many ways, just that way. It is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Terry Teachout joins us from New York. Terry, talk about Mood Indigo. I have loved this song from the instant I heard it and have never stopped. I don't know if this is my favorite rendition ever, but what's the origin of the song?
Well, it's his first great hit. It was written while he was at the Cotton Club. And it is, like many of Ellington's compositions, not entirely his own work. The opening section, the chorale that it begins with for the three horns, that's Ellington. The tune that you just heard, the one that's sung to the words that are familiar, you know, I got that mood indigo.
Yep.
That was brought to him by Barney Bigard, the New Orleans clarinetist whom you just heard playing it a moment ago. And Bigard himself got part of that tune, very likely, from one of his teachers down in New Orleans, Lorenzo Tio. So Duke Ellington's role as a composer really is summed up in miniature by looking at this song, because he is a synthesist. He's somebody who takes disparate elements coming from him, coming from his musicians, coming from other sources, and like a film director, like an auteur, he blends them into a consistent and complete whole that is his own.
I mean, he had so much to work with in that band, that orchestra that he put together. And you can hear a lot of that vividness on display in this track. This is The Mooch. This is 1928, a product of his time in Harlem's Cotton Club. Mid-tempo swing described as a sex dance. Thank you. All right, we're downright on the body end of the block here, and yet that wonderful cascade has still got that elegance to it. But he's pulling those both together, and all the vivaciousness of that band of his. Man, he had strings to pull here.
Yes, he did. He had a band full of hand-picked musicians, chosen because they inspired him, chosen because they could bring things to him that maybe he didn't have. And he was the genius who knew how to take all those ingredients and put them together into a dish like this.
What did he think about... Here he was working with a very visceral, even sexual musical tradition, and at the same time, very much wanting to be seen as the Carnegie Hall Stravinsky equivalent. Was that a tension for Duke Ellington, or did it flow together naturally?
I think it was a creative tension. Mm-hmm. He was raised in bourgeois respectability, and it was essential to him throughout his life to appear respectable to the public at large. It was very important to him to play in a place like Carnegie Hall. But at the same time, he was what he was, and part of what he was this tremendously earthy man who had an inexhaustible, really inexhaustible appetite for women. And you can hear these two sides of his character in this specific piece of music.
We've got a little tape of him here. People asked how he composed, where he got his ideas from. And here's Duke Ellington. This is 1964 on Canadian television, keeping it kind of dreamy.
Ideas? Oh, man, I got a million dreams. That's all I do is dream all the time.
I thought you played piano.
No, this is not piano. This is dreaming.
This is not piano. This is dreaming. Duke Ellington right there in 1964. Terry Teachout's new biography is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. He's joined us from New York. Let's go to Shirley in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to hear more. But Shirley, what do you know?
I am well. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I had to call in and tell you what my fascination was with the great Duke. I'm from Buffalo, New York originally.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the extreme pleasure of growing up in a very versatile musical community. I am a freelance musician, performer myself as of today. But when I was 14 years old in Buffalo, New York, Duke Ellington came to Klein Hands Music Hall in Buffalo. You know, familiar with that?
Tell us, in what year might that have been?
Well, that would have been 1964. I was 14 years old at the time.
Okay.
And we got a call. The call group that I was involved with very heavily at that time was just at the top of their game, and we got a call that they wanted us to be a part. Duke was looking for a choir that was very versatile,
mm-hmm.
eclectic in style, and we were chosen. And that was the most serene experience of my life in meeting that man. He was the coolest dude. But what we did for the performance was we walked in, and of course I was nervous, and the orchestra was there.
No
and
doubt.
Duke raised his baton, and he said, "You're getting ready to go on a flight with me. Don't be afraid. Just do what I tell you to do." And so I was sitting there waiting for music or something. He says, "When I raise this baton, I want every one of your orchestra members and every one of the choir members to just quietly bellow out any note that you want."
What? Are you kidding?
No, I'm not. And so we all like, is he serious? He raised the baton. And I get goosebumps even thinking of it now. I can't tell you what kind of sound was created when we did that. He was so ahead of his time and
yeah.
everything.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine the coolest new age sound. And he says, "And then when I move the baton again, I want you to go anywhere you want to go."
That's a man with some confidence in himself and in you. And in you. Shirley, what did he stand for to you, Duke Ellington?
He was majestic. He was a genius. He was not afraid to do anything that that he knew could be expressed through music, which was anything. And to have that kind of example at 14, and then in 1999, when Mercedes was on tour celebrating his, what would have been his 100th birthday, well, my very good friend, who was the conductor for her performance, well, we all got out to go out and eat with Mercedes and talk with her and share her father's view of everything, and of course her grandfather. And to be able to share that with her, she says, "Oh, you just brought my father back alive."
And it just keeps coming. Right, the 100th anniversary of the 1899 birth of Duke Ellington. But we'll picture you on stage in 1964 with the Duke, and everybody sing "Just What You Will," and the nerve starts to sort of run with that. Shirley, thank you so much for your call from Nashville. By 1940. One of his greatest compositions, Coco, minor key blues, not to be mistaken for Charlie Parker's Coco, but you can hear a marked shift here in how Ellington was approaching composition and the sound he was trying to create by 1940, Coco. Ellington's Coco, 1940. Terry Teachout just dropped off the line, but I'm glad to have all of my callers and listeners with us. Sherry in Canton, Massachusetts. Sherry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the best concert of my entire life. It was Duke Ellington at Dartmouth College in 1972. I was an exchange student there in my junior year, and the Sunday night concert sold out.
Yeah.
Lucky for me, since I was writing movie and theater reviews for the paper, I was in the office on Monday morning and found out that they added a last-minute concert on Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And without even a breath, I bought a ticket, and I was third row center. And I will never forget this. On every number, Duke Ellington put the spotlight on another person in the orchestra and talked about that musician. Never once on himself, and after every number, he got a standing ovation. And here it is, 41 years later, and I remember it like yesterday. It was just the best concert of my life. I'll never forget him.
Sherry, thank you so much for painting that picture. Terry Teachout, I think we've got you back, and I'm glad we do.
I believe so.
Describe how he did it, how he plucked this, not exactly from the air, but from what he heard from his own musicians in the band, how he composed. It was kind of a singular, almost pastiche style.
Yes. Ellington, he chose the people who inspired him, the people who had the ability to bring new colors, new ideas into the band. And then remember that he's out on the road with them, you know, more than 300 nights a year. That's where mm-hmm. he wants to be. So he's always hearing them, warming up, playing solos. He's always on the qui vive for a surprise from them. And then if a musician will suddenly play a solo with a particularly striking phrase, people used to see him writing it down on his collar, on his cuffs of his shirt, and he will weave it maybe the next day or the next week into a composition in which this may be part of the theme, it may be a background riff, and suddenly this fragment of music that was in the air a few nights later has become a full-blown composition.
Lots of listeners writing in, Terry. Shazmak says, brilliant, classy, trailblazer, trendsetter. George, simply one of the top five of the greatest American composers, one of the few American royals. He certainly had that that persona. Italo as an arranger unsurpassed, as a pianist underrated, as a writer in a class of his own. And then Lim says, you know, don't forget his great collaborator Billy Strayhorn, the genius behind the genius. What about that, Terry?
Well, an entire chapter is devoted to Strayhorn in this book. Strayhorn is in and of himself a fascinating character. Came into the Ellington Band in 39 when he was a very young man. Ellington immediately saw his unique gift for writing in a style influenced by, related by Ellington, but not like his. It was entirely personal. And from then until Strayhorn's own death in the mid-60s, Ellington used him to arrange pop songs, to write Strayhorn's own music that was played by the band, including Ellington's theme song, Take the A-Train, was written by Strayhorn, not Ellington. But this collaboration took place out of sight. Strayhorn did not normally appear in public with the band. He was not in his lifetime especially well known. And the reason for this is that Billy Strayhorn was a homosexual at a time when one could not be a homosexual and a public figure in jazz or in any other part of American life. So for Strayhorn, it was a bargain. Ellington played his music. He paid Strayhorn generously. Strayhorn lived the life he wanted to lead, but he lived it off stage, out of the spotlight.
Duke Ellington had his sights on Carnegie Hall for a long time. He talked about it for a long time, for years, about how he was writing this great piece, this great suite that he would one day take there. He finally did Black, Brown, and Beige, a tone parallel to the history of the American Negro, he called it. We'll play it in just a minute, but introduce this for us. You call it a great crystallizing moment in his life.
Yes, it was. Ellington, the theme of racial pride, as we talked about earlier, had always been central to his work and his sense of self. And for, well, more than a decade, well over a decade before the writing of Black, Brown, and Beige, he was talking about writing a multi-movement suite. But Duke Ellington was quite famous for building verbal castles in the sky. And so far as we know, he didn't write a note of Black, Brown, and Beige until about 6 weeks before the premiere. He's out on the road. He's playing shows in movie theaters. And he, you know, the clock is running. And he realizes, I'm going to be at Carnegie Hall in 6 weeks. And I told them that I was going to have this big suite, and I've been talking about it for years. Time to get down to business.
Let's hear it right here. Black, Brown, and Beige. Movement one. Movement one, Black. What was the reception, Terry?
The audience went wild. The critics were all over the place. There were not jazz critics in 1943 in the way that we know them today. Most of the people who came to review Black, Brown, and Beige for the New York newspapers were classical critics, some of whom knew something about jazz, some of whom knew nothing about jazz. And so the reviews were, to call them mixed would be the grossest kind of understatement. And the piece itself is mixed in quality. Some of the more astute critics understood that Ellington was trying to do something more ambitious than he'd ever done before, in some respects maybe a little bit beyond him, and others just didn't get what was going on.
What did he think of what he had created? What did he say, anyway, in public or in private? You've looked at more than the public statements.
I have indeed. I mean, he regarded this as the clinching masterpiece, the great effort, you know, where he tries to take a bold step forward technically. He didn't talk about being disappointed by the reception of the piece. But we know he was, because he only played the complete Black, Brown, and Beige twice more after the Carnegie Hall premiere. After that, he only played excerpts from it. And for a man as proud as Ellington, that tells you more than any words can possibly say.
He may have come up through the Cotton Club, but once again right here, it was all about race. A tone parallel to the history of the American Negro, Black, Brown, and Beige. Terry Teachout writes wonderfully about Duke Ellington in the big new biography, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. We'll go out here with Warm Valley, 1940. A beautiful love tune with some sensual undertones, shall we say. You can join us this hour. How do you see how Duke Ellington handled race, the music, this country and culture? The one he performed in, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Terry Teachout. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great showman, the great jazz man, Duke Ellington, the aristocrat of jazz. Was the PR label his own people put on him, and it stuck. He carried it. Terry Teachout writes about his music and his enigmatic life in many ways, though so much in the public eye, in his big new book, wonderful book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Behind us right here, Billy Strayhorn's composition that Ellington more or less made his own, Take the A-Train, 1941. You can join us this hour. How do you see Duke Ellington in the way he handled the country he was living in, performing in, creating in? Where do you put Ellington in the evolution of jazz, of our culture? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. That bouncing tune, just wonderful. Terry Teachout, you take us to lots of angles that we may not ordinarily see, including right on the cover of your book, where you've got a photograph, wonderful photograph, Duke Ellington, pencil in hand, cigarette in hand, looks like he's composing from his left side, and we see running just under his cheekbone, from sort of the sideburn on down, a remarkable scar with a big story, kind of a window into much of his life, Terry.
Yes, indeed. That scar was given to him by his wife one night in bed. She pulled out a razor. She said to him, I'm going to spoil those pretty looks. And she slashed him, and he departed that evening without his clothes and never came back. He was seeing other women. He always saw other women. He was a man who couldn't get enough female company. And there are stories in my book that sounds like they could have come out of a French farce from the late 19th century, you know, with all the eight doors in the set and the multiple partners.
I mean, literally, you have him reserving multiple hotel rooms on any given night and putting different women in each one.
A different lady in every room. And this wasn't, you know, these stories are fascinating in their own right, but they're also directly related to the theme of who Ellington was as an artist, because he was inspired by women and by the act of sex itself, which he once wrote an article for Ebony in which he talks about, you know, the glory of the sex symphony. That's what he called it.
Mm-hmm.
It was he couldn't do without it. We listened to a composition a few moments ago called Warm Valley.
Yeah.
Well, he's not talking about geography right in that piece.
Yes. Quite clearly, if you listen, and quite clearly a man who adored, as you say, needed, couldn't get enough. But it's also a source of this sort of this kind of ennui here as well, because he never stops. It just keeps going. And you describe,
I think it's the quintessential Don Juan complex. He mm-hmm. was, and also a man who, on some level, he may have feared women, as well he had reason to, having been attacked by his wife, and who certainly saw them with a measure of distrust. After the marriage, I don't think he ever wanted any woman to really get so close to him that she had any kind of control over his life. And that makes him a very equivocal figure in reading and about and trying to understand his love life. His son, Mercer, thought that he hated women, actually went so far as to suggest that.
And that what? His bouncing around was somehow evidence of that?
Yes, yes. I mean, it was that all women were to be used for whatever his purposes were, pleasure, inspiration, but that they were never, you didn't give them a piece of yourself. That's what Mercer thought, and although Mercer had his own complicated views about his father, you can't help but think, looking at Ellington's lifetime, that somewhere in there is a nugget of truth.
After Duke Ellington died, you remind us, Mercer found this handwritten note among his father's papers in which, as you write, Ellington summed himself up in three lapidary sentences. No problem. I'm easy to please. I just want to have everybody in the palm of my hand, quoting his own words. And you then go on to say his selfishness was unswerving.
Yes.
Meaning?
He structured his life so that it would work to suit his needs at all times, so that the band would be available for him, the women would be available for him. He, insofar as possible, didn't have to do what he didn't want to do. And this was so that all of his energies could be directed ultimately toward the end of making music. Like many geniuses, and that word is not too strong to describe Duke Ellington, he was self-centered in a profound and ultimately creative way. But self-centered he was. That doesn't mean he wasn't generous on his own terms. He was immensely generous to family members, to the members of the band, but he was number one, and he knew that.
You got these just amazing, wonderful passages. You know, so he chose to keep on being Duke Ellington, racing from town to town, sleeping with woman after woman, shoveling his songwriting royalties into the till in order to pay his expensive gentlemen salaries big enough to keep them riding on the band bus, cranking it all, and on it goes. And this wonderful from Rex Stewart, the cornetist, kind of describing how Ellington would stand before the band just picking little bits out of the air. I mean, he really relied on them, their riffing, to feed his composition process machine.
That's right. This is a man who wrote 1,700 musical compositions in his lifetime. And he was always looking for inspiration in sights and sounds and feelings and in the music played by the members of his band.
He went into a kind of eclipse in the later 40s, early 50s, and then Newport Jazz Festival, 1956, Duke Ellington and his orchestra gave what jazz promoter George Wein called a performance that, quote, stood for everything that jazz had been and could be. Here's Ellington soloing over the crowd's loud cheers on his Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, 1956, Newport Jazz Festival. A kind of triumphant return, and you can hear the crowd just eating it up there, Terry.
They were literally dancing in the aisles that night. People were just going mad. Because Ellington, as you say, had been in eclipse for a few years. End of the big band era, big bands are going away, pop singers and now rock and roll. Duke Ellington is he's from the Dead Letter office. Comes roaring into the Newport Jazz Festival, pulls out this composition, which is not a new piece, wrote it in 1937, plays it for, it goes on for, 20 minutes, and one crescendo after another, and by the end of it, people were screaming, absolutely screaming. A couple of weeks later, he's on the cover of Time magazine. He's back at the center of the world again.
And with that, sort of gave himself, a passport for big prominence for the rest of his life. Let's go to Norman, Oklahoma. Gordon is calling. Hi, Gordon. You're on the air with Terry Teachout.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really think that was the effect of segregation that slowed Ellington down so that he gave us all these things that ordinary people can appreciate. If it hadn't been for that, he would have never been in the Cotton Club, and he would have never done the Satin Doll and A-Train things that ordinary people can appreciate. He would have been far out beyond Stravinsky and had written Black, Brown, and Beige in 1930.
Hey, Gordon, I can understand exactly what you're talking about there, the headwinds that he faced with a lot of elan, it must be said. But Terry, what about it? The degree to which the racial structure, stratification barriers of our society influenced this man, the creator.
It's a very interesting perspective. I mean, Ellington could have spent his life writing symphonies, as the caller suggests. But he was, at all times in his career, a popular band leader, playing for dances, making music for a popular audience. And he saw it was his job is to play music that satisfied him, the composer, but also satisfied the dancers in the audience. And that is a creative synthesis, not just known in Ellington's music, not just known in the music of black band leaders, but in all popular musicians who have to bring together the desires of the public and their interior creative needs. And if you do it right, and if, like Ellington, you're a genius, then it becomes a profoundly creative synthesis.
But he used his public persona to in some ways, wade through this period. You write, for all his polish, it was his artistry, not his personality, that was the source of his enduring appeal. But it was the personality, that glamorous elegance, that made white people who might not otherwise have done so give him a second chance and in time open doors of opportunity through which few other blacks had been allowed to pass. I mean, he was the Duke. How could you not open the door?
That's right. There'd never really been a black public figure like Duke Ellington to come along in American life in the 20s and 30s. This fantastically polished and charismatic man who is being treated as a great composer, and yet he is black. He is somebody who can't order a meal at most restaurants in the city that he came from, Washington, D.C. And part of why he presented himself in the way that he did as the Duke was as a symbol of black aspiration, as an inspiration for blacks, and I think also to signal to white people, take me seriously, take us seriously. We are not as you think we are. And that message came through loud and clear.
I mean, he was willing. Here's a little bit, 1963 interview with Swedish television of Duke Ellington. And he's talking a little about stage fright and how he feels it. But listen here, he's also very clear. He and his band, Jazz Giants.
When I walk on stage, I always enjoy a little stage fright. And, of course, then I must muster up a certain amount of courage and get the ranks closed in and try and have the kids blow the fright away, you know. And, of course, we have an organization of musical instrumentalists who are considered jazz giants internationally, and they make a major contribution toward blowing away this stage fright.
Why have fright of any kind? You've got that band behind you, and when you are Duke Ellington, when Miles Davis said that musicians should all get down on their knees and praise this man, what exactly was he talking about there, Terry?
Well, he meant, I believe, that Ellington was, as I call him in this book, the great jazz composer of the 20th century. He writes tunes that every jazz musician performs. He is himself a personal inspiration, and he finds these extraordinarily gifted artists in the band, like Johnny Hodges, the great alto saxophone player, like Cootie Williams, the trumpeter. This package that he gives to the world, of which he is the man who ties the ribbon, Miles knew as well as or better than anybody else just how central that package was to the way that jazz took shape.
Let's hear some from later on. He was still playing into the 70s, and this is his New Orleans suite, Blues for New Orleans, featuring the longtime friend and alto sax player Johnny Hodges. Last time he was recorded before he died with Duke Ellington, 1970 New Orleans suite, Blues for New Orleans. You write, Terry, you remind us that he refused to call his music jazz. You quote him saying, "I don't write jazz. I write Negro folk music." What did he mean by that? And you go right on to say he was wrong, but what did he mean? What do you mean?
Well, a lot of jazz musicians of Ellington's generation thought that the word jazz had connotations that they thought were beneath them and beneath the music. Its roots are as a synonym for sex, and they just saw it as below what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. The word is now completely accepted. We all use it. We all know what it means. But when Ellington said he was writing Negro folk music, it means that he was writing a music that draws from all kinds of sources. I mean, what we're listening to here, recorded in the 70s, this is a guy in his 70s who's keeping his ears wide open.
Yeah.
You know, that could be Ray Charles on that band.
Yes.
He's always listening to find out what's going on out there in the world. And I think maybe that's part of the folk music angle that he's talking about.
Let's go to Joe in Boston. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Howdy. I saw every performance Duke Ellington ever had at the Strand and the Paramount. I'm an ex-New Yorker who thinks Boston's a small hick town. Although I spent Boston Globe as a cartoonist, illustrator, and designer, I sure miss New York. And I tell you, Duke was really something. When I was just a 10-year-old kid, I couldn't get into a nightclub without either bribing the doorman or having an older person with me. But I caught just about every performance you could of Duke Ellington, and I had a record collection, which I gave away to choice friends and relatives when I started moving around a lot, and that's how I wound up in Boston. I retired to Cape Cod when I was, I guess I was 36 when I retired the first time. I took a business from $700,000 to $3 million.
And I guess you took Duke Ellington right with you through all that, Joe. Every show that you could get into. Thanks for your call. Terry Teachout, you say that, you know, you may think you know Duke Ellington, but you don't. What is it that we know that's true, and what did you find that we don't first think of?
We know the great artist. We know how important and significant he was. We don't, for the most part, know how complex the collaboration was with his musicians, how much he took from them, how he was sometimes willing not to credit them for crucial contributions. We don't know so much about the private life, about the complex relations with women, the equivocal attitudes toward them. We don't know, as you said earlier in the program, we don't know about the rage, which is something he kept out of sight. We don't know about the anxiety. I think many people listening to this program would have been surprised to think that Duke Ellington experienced stage fright, for example.
You take that seriously, the stage fright? I mean, I guess every performer has a little bit of it, but this looked like a man so in charge.
Oh, he confessed to it on more than one occasion. I mean, I think most people who get in front of an audience, they know that the audience can like them or not like them. And even after a lifetime of achievement, you're only as good as your last gig.
A complex character, but you know, we're all complex characters and we don't all create what Duke Ellington did. What a magnificent legacy.
Don't.
Wow. You tell the
story. A legacy for the ages, yes.
You've got it right there. You tell the story so beautifully and well. The new biography is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Terry Teachout, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for coming.
For me as well. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Duke Ellington. Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington by Terry Teachout. Enjoy. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.